MacCast, Monday, September 10th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we are in Apple Keynote Week. I'm starting off this week. Hopefully you're hearing this podcast before we get to Wednesday this year. Wednesday the 12th, Apple is going to hold their Gather Round special event at the campus there, the new Apple Park in the Steve Jobs Theater, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific time. They're going to be streaming it. I'm sure I will be online on Twitter. We'll probably try to get the IRC chat up and running. If you want to come hang out in there, you can get the details at maccast.com. I'll put a post up there. I believe it's maccast.com/chat. If you want to participate in that, I'll make sure that's running that morning and we can all hang out and talk about all of the announcements kind of in real time. And of course, I'll be giving coverage on the MacCast after all of that. But this week, because it is kind of right before the announcement time, of course, a lot of the stuff we have to talk about in the news today has to do with the latest kind of rumors leading into the event. We're kind of getting a pretty clear picture of what's going to be announced. Hopefully, it's not totally spoiled and there's a surprise or two in there. There usually is. Usually there's something that Apple will throw out there that we didn't really get in the rumor mill, although it seems to be pretty filled up this year, I have to say. The leaks have been coming fast and heavy, but we're going to get in. We're going to talk a little bit more about iPhone and iPhone pricing, some new things there. Talk a little bit more about iPad Pro rumors. There was a leaked images that seemed to indicate a little more of what it's going to look like, and those were actually surprising this week. We have some Apple Watch stuff to talk about, more Apple video content for their original video service, as well as some predictions on how that service might do versus, say, services that are more well-established like Netflix and things like that. And then we have a couple of exploits to warn you about and tell you about. Something happened with a couple of apps on the Mac App Store, and we'll get into that. And that'll kind of round out the news for this week. Then we're going to get into some of your feedback. We're going to talk about the fall upgrade cycle and whether or not you're going to be upgrading. I told you my opinion on this year's devices and asked you to share some of your thoughts, and you did that. We're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to get more into Apple Watch usage and kind of delve a little bit deeper into that conversation. Somebody sent me an email that I found very interesting about maybe the future of Apple's devices and smart devices and our iPhones and stuff like that. So I want to talk about that a little bit. There's a little update to Apple Music that addressed something that I talked about way back in February of this year. So I want to fill you in on that. And then we're going to teach you how to use the Force. And that'll make more sense toward the end of the episode. But that's going to round things out. Should be a really good episode. I just want to dive right into things, though. I don't want to wait any longer getting into some of the latest Apple rumors going into this event. So Boy Genius Reports and 9to5Mac claimed this week that they have sources with, quote, knowledge of Apple's marketing, each of them presumably separate sources, although I would assume this could be the same source. Those sources are claiming that Apple is considering a little bit different naming scheme than we talked about last time for the iPhone X. Actually, this has become the big thing this week. What is Apple going to call these new iPhones? And there seems to be a lot of debate around there, to the point where I almost have to wonder, is Apple marketing actually leaking this stuff out on purpose just to give general confusion so we don't know what the actual names are going to be? Yeah, it's starting to feel that way a little bit, to be honest with you. This time around, there's a couple of weird naming conventions that surfaced, and I'm not so sure I'm really buying into it. But Boy Genius Reports and 9to5Mac both claim that this year's large-size iPhone, what would normally be the Plus model, but taking on that iPhone X design, they say it might be the iPhone XS Max. And if you remember, last week we talked about the fact that there's this prediction that Apple is going to make this an S-series year and take the iPhone X naming, add the S, and call the new models, the 5.8-inch model, and the larger 6.5-inch model, the iPhone XS. And yes, there's a lot of jokes flying around, and I've heard from many of you that tennis joke. you know, I don't know. It's weird, right? It does feel weird, and actually the naming conventions get weirder with 10S Max. And the reason cited in the piece made it even more puzzling to me, because they said iPhone 10S Plus is just a mouthful and difficult to say, but iPhone 10S Max is easier to pronounce. What? I had to wonder if maybe Apple's marketing team is back on that High Sierra retreat that they went on when they came up with the naming for macOS 10 High Sierra. Yeah, I don't know. It sounds weird to me, but that's the latest rumor. They also talked about the 6.1-inch model, or we heard about the 6.1-inch LCD model this week and its potential name. There's been some rumors flying around. One I missed, apparently, was at some point somebody said it might be called the iPhone 10R. Supposedly the R means reality, like virtual reality, augmented reality. I have to say, you know, let's get real on that one. That sounds lame. Sorry, not buying it. This week we did hear, though, and this came from infamous Apple leaker Ben Geskin. He posted a couple of images and said that the new model would be the iPhone XC, following in line with the iPhone C we had a few years back, which stood for color. These new iPhones, the iPhone X LCD model, the 6.1-inch lower-cost model, is expected to come in a variety of colors. And so that naming convention, I'm kind of buying. You know, if Apple's going with the XS moniker for the two premium phones in the two different sizes, iPhone XC seems to make a lot of sense. And it will look a lot like the current iPhone 10 model, very similar design with a single lens EyeSight camera, and then it's going to have an aluminum band around the side rather than a stainless steel band. But in looking at these leaked, what he called prototypes, not even like blanks or anything like that, actual prototypes, it looked just like an iPhone 10. He showed off colors in white, red, and I think it was black, although in some of the images it looked like a dark blue, and there is a rumor there might be a blue. There was also a like rose gold kind of version, and that gold version actually did show an image of what appeared to be a dual SIM tray, something else that has been leaked and rumored for a while, although it might be a China-only feature. And as a matter of fact, also this week, both China Telecom and China Mobile were teasing that the next iPhone would have dual SIM support, so kind of leaking that ahead of some of Apple's announcements. So it's looking like that may happen. Moving back to the potential colors for the 6.1-inch model, Ming-Chi Kuo had also mentioned a while back that he was expecting gray, white, blue, red, and orange. Didn't specifically mention a black, but again, the Ben Geskin images did look like there was a black version as well. So we'll have to see, but that's likely coming in multiple colors, and therefore I kind of buy the iPhone XC naming. Bloomberg has also reported that that model may have potential production issues, Apple having some light leaking having to do with how the backlights attached to the new LCD screen, and they are going edge to edge on this thing, which is something apparently very difficult to do with an LCD screen. And so because of those problems, they're expecting there might be supply shortages at launch for that particular model. The other reason for potential supply shortages given in the same piece from Bloomberg was that Apple wants to hold back supplies to try and push sales of the higher priced OLED models. I'm calling BS on that one. I don't think that's something that Apple would ever do. It's fully expected that the 6.1-inch model is probably going to vastly outsell the other two higher price point models. Something like 48% of iPhones are predicted to be the LCD version, and I think that makes sense. More on the pricing here in a little bit, because that pricing may fluctuate a little bit, and I do have a feeling that's going to impact how many people are going to buy which model. The other thing we're hearing from Ming-Chi Kuo is that the 2018 iPhone models are going to retain their Lightning connector. There had been some debate on whether Apple might go with USB-C. And also, unfortunately, we're hearing that they're likely going to be bundled with just a 5-watt power adapter, not the 18-watt USB-C power adapter that was potentially being rumored, at least according, again, to the latest stuff we're hearing from Ming-Chi Kuo, and he's a pretty reliable analyst when it comes to Apple rumors. So just real quick about that iPhone pricing. It's been predicted that the U.S. pricing is going to be in the range of $600 to $700 for the base models of the 6.1-inch iPhone X or 10C. I almost did it. I almost called it XS or XC. No, 10C. $800 to $900 starting price point for the 5.8-inch iPhone XS. And $900 to $1,000 starting price points for the iPhone XS Plus or XS Max, depending on what that naming might be. I have a feeling on the higher end, it may be a little bit too optimistic. I could see that price fluctuate up by about $100. So $900 to $1,000 for the iPhone XS and $1,000 to $1,100 for starting price points of the iPhone X Plus. But if it is the lower prices, I think Apple will sell a lot more models. So I'm hoping that the lower price points are spot on, but that does seem like Apple bringing pricing down, something they're not typically apt to do when they're releasing new models. They're generally trying to drive the price up so they can make a little bit more money. And I think they could potentially get away with it, but maybe they're trying to strike that nice balance between price point and the number of sales. And I think lower price points would make a lot of happy iPhone buyers out there. Sticking on iPhones for a minute, when will we actually be able to receive these iPhones? It's expected that Apple's going to, again, when we know they're making the announcement on the 12th, it's expected that pre-sales are going to start up on Friday, so immediately on the 14th, and all signs have been pointing to them actually shipping the devices a week later. And as a matter of fact, a leak from an Italian shipper's internal messaging system this week said that their employees should expect higher workloads on September 21st. And this is a shipper that does shipping for Apple in Italy. And so that's leading many to suspect that that kind of confirms the iPhone X series ship date on the 21st. So it's going to be a rapid rollout from announcement to actually receiving these devices a little bit quicker than in the years past. And that's, again, because the designs are not changing too much. Yes, we're getting the larger size version, but there's not a lot of internal changes. And that means generally Apple doesn't have many shipping delays. We'll have to see how the 10C does and if that one ends up being in short supply. But it's not sounding like this year that the update, the 10S or the XS Plus, are going to have a problem in terms of being able to order them. So get your credit cards ready on Friday, because you're going to be, if you're planning on buying this year, that's the day you're going to have to plunk the money down. And as far as what new features people want in iPhones, USA Today ran a very interesting SurveyMonkey survey of 1,665 U.S. adults to ask what iPhone features they most want. And 75% said longer battery life. And I have to wonder, what are you people doing with your phones? I generally, over the past several years, have not had problems with battery life on my iPhones. They last a few days. It seems adequate to me. Yes, better battery life is nice and always a welcome addition, but I'm just surprised that that many people, that would be the big buying factor, the big reason or big feature they would want in a future iPhone. After that, 66% said shatterproof glass screen. I was hoping that more people would want that, just judging from the phones that I see out and about. I can't tell you the number of iPhones out there that I see with cracked glass, and it just bugs the heck out of me. I could not live with a shattered screen, but so many people do, so it'd be nice if that problem went away. 44% said they want expandable storage, and I totally understand this, but it reaffirms my thought for many iPhone users out there. Yeah, you likely want to get the buy the version with the most amount of storage that you can afford. I think this one comes out of the fact that people are trying to save money. They buy the lower end model at 32 gigabytes and figure out that that's not enough storage, and they should have bought the 128 gigabyte model or the 256 gigabyte model. And yeah, it'd be nice to have expandable storage. It's something you have on Android, on some Android devices. That number didn't really surprise me. 39% said they want to be able to charge and listen on headphones at the same time. But interestingly, 37% said they wanted the headphone jack back. So I don't know if those people in the 39% aren't using Bluetooth devices, because you can charge and listen with a Bluetooth device in the current models that have wireless charging. So I was a little bit confused by that one. 29% said they want a more standardized USB-C style connector instead of the Lightning connector, and 19%, and I'm in this group, said make Face ID better. That's what we really, really want. And guess what? Only about 10% of those surveyed said get rid of the notch. We hate the notch. And this is a year after, remember, so much notch hatred. So everybody got over that one pretty quickly. Most surprisingly in this survey, I have to say, is that it doesn't seem like anybody asked for better cameras or better camera features. Now, I wasn't able to actually see the survey, so maybe these were leading questions and no one was asked about that, but I would have thought that would have been high up on the list too. People always want better camera and better camera features, you know, better zoom, better optical zoom, better image stabilization, better resolution, all those sorts of things. And I assume they didn't ask about the CPU or GPU improvements, because that's something that just tends to always happen as we upgrade new devices. So I don't know. What do you think? Yeah, this how does this list sound to you? Does it make sense? A few of those were a little bit odd to me. Ming-Chi Kuo said fingerprint on display technology this next year is going to grow by 500% in 2019 on devices, but Apple is not going to be part of it. He says Apple seems to be happy with Face ID and developing Face ID technology, and they're more than happy to let Android makers sort of experiment with the fingerprint on display technology. And apparently the latest addition to fingerprint on display technology is that they're working on whole screen sensing, so you don't have to put your fingerprint in any specific position on the screen. And I guess I should have explained, fingerprint on display technology means, you know, doing a fingerprint sensor through the LCD panel, through the glass, something that Apple had reportedly been working on before they announced Face ID, but had basically abandoned because it just wasn't that reliable, a little bit tricky. So looking like a lot of Android makers are going to play around with that technology this year. It's expected to be coming, I think, on the next Galaxy phone. So we'll have to see how that performs. Maybe they've worked through a lot of the issues and Apple may adopt it in the future, but for right now, sounding like Face ID is here to stay, much to my chagrin. Actually, you know, I hate to keep bagging on Face ID. I'm actually getting more comfortable with it in iOS 12. It does seem to be a little bit better for me on my iPhone 10. I don't know if they'll have improved Face ID technology in the iPhone 10s models. We haven't really been hearing that, but I would expect Apple to do a slight performance enhancement to that. It's something they did with Touch ID. I don't see why they wouldn't do it with Face ID. And so it will get better over time. And I've said that since the very beginning. I still struggle with it here and there, but overall it's performing pretty well. I would say, you know, 90% of the time, maybe 95% of the time, it's working for me on the first try. It's just not that 100% that I had with Touch ID. And so if you are planning to upgrade this year, something I would advise you to do now is check the availability. If you are on the iPhone, you know, every year upgrade program, you're going to need to settle up your accounts because the timing is a little bit different, especially if you bought an iPhone 10 on the upgrade program from Apple last year. Remember, the iPhone 10 didn't ship until November, so you weren't charged. If you want to buy in September a new iPhone, you're going to have to settle up. You need to get to 12 payments on that program before you can upgrade. You also need to go through a credit check if you're in the US and do some other things. So get on Apple's website before order day on Friday and take care of all that stuff. Make sure that you're still going. And also, if you bought a new iPhone in the last 6 months on the upgrade program, remember, you have to have been on the program for at least 6 months before you're eligible to upgrade, even if you're going to pay the difference to get up to the 12 months of payments. So you're not going to be able to upgrade until you get at least 6 months in and you've made 12 individual payments. Remember all that stuff, because every year I do hear from many of you who are upset because you go to try and do the upgrade, you know, midnight on Friday and find out there's some problem. So try and make sure, check with Apple, contact Apple, you know, Apple through their website. The Apple Store support people are great on chat. get with them, make sure you're fully eligible, you've got all your credit checks in place, you have your credit cards, and you need to do that even if you're already on the program. I believe they redo your credit check in the United States every year. I could be wrong on that because I haven't been on the program, but I do think you probably have to pass another credit check to be able to upgrade. So just check in on all that stuff and make sure you're ready to go. I don't want to get any emails from people who are upset or disappointed because they weren't able to upgrade this year. So that's kind of everything with iPhone. This year's iPad, the iPad Pro, is expected to be updated. We're expected to get an 11-inch model and a 12.9-inch model, again, with reduced bezels, the TrueDepth camera system, Face ID technology, no home button, very much looking like an iPad version or an iPad Pro version of the iPhone X design. At least that's kind of what we expected. But there was a collaboration between OnLeaks, and MySmartPrice, and they put together some high-resolution renders based on some leaked images and schematics that purport to be the design for this year's iPad Pro. And while they did have the thin equal bezels all the way around, and the Touch ID, or the, excuse me, not Touch ID, the TrueDepth camera system, I don't know why I have so much trouble remembering TrueDepth camera system, but I do. TrueDepth camera system technology, but no notch. So actually, they're still able to integrate that on the iPad, supposedly, into the thin bezel. But the big design change that it seems to have from the current iPad Pros and the iPhone X design is they're showing a design that has squared off edges, more reminiscent of an iPhone SE, or, you know, what originally began with the iPhone 4, right? That flat square band around the edge. Also, the new iPad is expected to have the antenna lines all the way around and across the back, like the current iPhone X models do. Another thing that they're showing is that smart connector being moved to the back and the bottom, or on the portrait side of the iPad, which is really weird and would require a whole new smart keyboard to come along with the design. Actually, it would have probably already required a new smart keyboard because these are expected to be smaller, even with the larger screen, because of the reduced bezels, they're going to be a slightly smaller form factor, but I'm just not really sure how the new smart keyboard is going to connect, if there's going to be some sort of little flap or something that wraps around, if that connector truly is on the back bottom of the iPad display. The theory has been that Face ID technology won't work in landscape, so they want to move that attachment for whatever reason. So I guess when you have it in a dock that uses the connector, it will be oriented right for Face ID, but iOS 12 code seems to indicate that Apple does have Face ID technology working in landscape mode. So that kind of throws out that theory. So we don't really know what's going on with that connector. I'm hoping that it's not accurate. It doesn't seem to make sense for me, to me, for it to be on that side. But regardless, that's what's in this render. Also, no headphone jack. That's expected to go away in this year's model. And it was also showing a strange little button on the middle right side of the iPad, where the smart connector, I think, would be currently, but it looks more like almost like a side button like you would have on an iPhone, and they didn't really know what that was for. They couldn't describe it, but it was in the spec that they were working off of, and so they had it in the render. We don't know what that is. And we're also hearing that this year's model may come with a USB-C connector instead of a Lightning connector, along with that 18-watt USB-C fast charger. And this is something that Ming-Chi Kuo has also sort of backed up. So it's looking like we may get the USB-C connector on the iPad Pro instead of a Lightning, and this could be the first sort of transition to Apple going with a standard USB-C connector. I don't know if it'll also be Thunderbolt, which could be interesting. That's not something that's in the rumors, but that is capable, and you're capable of running Thunderbolt through a USB-C style connector. So maybe Apple will have a high-speed connector on the iPad Pro, which might open up some very interesting things with accessories and stuff like that. Quote also claims that Apple will be releasing a new lower-priced MacBook with Touch ID and no Touch Bar relatively soon. Not necessarily at the event this week. It's expected Apple will have a separate Mac announcement, but that came out this week, and I just didn't have any other place to put it in the notes, so I'm slamming it in here with the iPad Pro announcements. Moving on to Apple Watch, Guillermo Rambo, another infamous Mac leaker who is now working for 9to5 Mac, or at least writing some pieces for 9to5 Mac, he did some analysis on the latest leaked images of the Apple Watch and started digging into watchOS 5, which he does, and he thinks he's nailed the possible resolution for this year's Series 4 Apple Watch. He thinks the 42mm display will be 384 by 480 pixels, which is a really great resolution, a lot more resolution, as a matter of fact. For comparison, the current resolution on the 42mm Apple Watch Series 3 is 312 by 390. So it's a significant upgrade. It would mean getting a lot more information on the screen, potentially, and also enlargement of a lot of the buttons that you might have in Apple Watch apps, which could make them easier to tap and easier to hit. Developers might have to do a bit of adjustment, though, to take advantage of that extra screen real estate, and we are expecting some new faces that will be exclusive for the new Apple Watch and will have additional complications. That was another thing that was in that leaked images. You had a complication or a watch face that had, I believe, 8 different complications being able to be displayed on it. So a lot more information on a single Apple Watch display. And also those thinner bezels that we're expecting on Apple Watch on this year's Apple Watch are going to help facilitate all that extra screen real estate without having to increase the size of the watch. Ming-Chi Kuo also added some new predictions to Apple Watch this week. He says that the new Apple Watch is going to support EKG sensors, electrocardiography. This is because of some new sensor technology, LED sensor technology, that Apple's going to put into this year's watch. And he also says all of the models are going to have some form of a ceramic back rather than the metal. And that looks like it's just mainly a materials change. I guess there's some advantages for mounting of the LEDs in the back there. But beyond that, you know, it's not anything that's needed to facilitate the electrocardiography or anything like that, as near as I can tell. So, few changes there. Apple Watch also has remained the top device in the global wearables market for the last quarter. This is according to the latest numbers from IDC. They say Apple shipped 4.7 million Apple Watches in the second quarter, grabbing a 17% share of the global market. This is the overall wearable market. Overall wearable shipments grew, they say, 5.5% from a year ago. And they cite slowing interest in basic health trackers and the release of the LTE Apple Watch Series 3 as really helping Apple retain the top position in the wearables market. So Apple Watch is selling very well. What I'm hearing from you and the rest of the community is a lot of people are very excited about the Apple Watch Series 4. We'll talk a little bit more about that later in this episode. And then one potential future development for Apple Watch, not sounding like it's going to be part of this year's announcements, but Apple has a couple of patents out there for artificially adjusting the brightness and colors of particular areas of an OLED display to prevent burn-in. And you might ask, well, why are they worried about burn-in? If you know the Apple Watch doesn't have an always-on display. Well, some Reddit users where this information was first leaked have been saying that Apple might be looking at using the technology to give the Apple Watch an always-on display of at least minimal information, probably the time. So you can look at your Apple Watch, it will always have the time displayed, even on an OLED display. The concern, of course, would be burn-in, but with this technology, Apple seems to have figured out a way to prevent that. And then really cool would be when you raise your wrist to look at your Apple Watch, the rest of the data and information, complications and things like that, would fade in around the time. So it'd be a really kind of cool effect, and you'd be able to have always on time and maybe not have a particularly large impact to the battery life, which is something Apple is always struggling with Apple Watch. Again, that's not looking like it's going to be part of this year's announcement, but could be coming in a future version of the Apple Watch. Apple has picked up, reportedly, some new video content this week. Apple had been scoping out the Toronto International Film Festival, looking for new content for their upcoming video streaming service, and it looks like they picked up at least one new item. They acquired the global rights to a feature-length documentary about an African elephant, actually the matriarch of an elephant herd, who has had, unfortunately, a drought in the watering hole they were using dry up, and they go on the search for a new watering hole to be their new home, and it's called The Elephant Queen. It's directed by award-winning wildlife filmmakers Victoria Stone and Mark Diebel, and is expected to come out on Apple's new service, which should be, we should hear more about sometime in 2019. We don't have a definitive date. We don't know how Apple's going to be rolling it out, what the price of the service is going to be. There's a lot of speculation around that, but it should be coming. So Apple, that, you know, quickly adding new content. I think we've, since this kind of started, where we heard the first reports of Apple's new video service and them forming a team, we've been hearing this steady stream of new content that they've been picking up. Also, right before that Toronto International Film Festival, Apple also reportedly secured the rights to an animated film, the next animated film, coming from Cartoon Salon and Melusine Productions. This is a movie called Wolf Walkers. It is the story of a young girl named Robin, whose father is a wolf hunter and brings her to Ireland during a time of superstition and magic. She befriends a wild girl that she meets and is transformed into the very thing her father is there to hunt. So that's the basic premise of that. The film is directed by two-time Oscar nominee Tom Moore and Ross Stewart, and Cartoon Salon is the same studio that's responsible for a bunch of award-winning and Oscar-nominated films, The Secret of the Kells, Song of the Sea, and The Breadwinner, all excellent films. I think you can get a lot of them on streaming. So if you haven't seen them, they have a very distinctive animation style, hand-drawn, cell kind of style. I don't know if they use technology. I'm assuming they use computers, but it's very much a hand-drawn style, and I think it's great stuff. A lot of it, because they are an Irish-based film studio based on Irish legends and things like that. Really fun stuff if you haven't seen any of it. But that's exciting that Apple is bringing that kind of quality animation to their service as well. So I'm the more I hear about these stories, the more I'm looking forward to Apple's new service. An interesting thing over in the EU, though, that could put a little bit of a wrench in that is there's supposedly some proposed laws in the EU that could require streaming services to produce 30% of their original on-demand programming content in Europe. So this would include services like Apple's new service, and they would be required to fund content produced in Europe, 30% of it, or either pay to produce their own content, you know, by either paying to produce their own content in Europe, acquiring existing series from regional producers, so companies that are already producing there and just simply buying 30% of their content from there, or by contributing to the national film funds in the EU. And I have a feeling that will be the option chosen by a lot of services like Apple and Hulu and Amazon and HBO and stuff like that, should this law come to pass. And the proposed regulation does need a vote that is coming up in December before it goes into effect. But the man in charge of the European Commission's department that regulates those communications networks, content, and technology, he says basically it's just a formality. This thing is going through. So that will impact a lot of new services and how they need to produce their content, at least for the EU. At the very least, it looks like the national film funds in the EU will be getting an influx of cash, which is good for independent filmmakers and folks in that region. So hopefully that's a good thing. I don't know about, you know, much about European EU politics. So if you are in that region and have a strong opinion about it, shoot us an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think about this requirement and its chances of actually going into effect. Is this accurate? You know, is it pretty much just a formality and a done deal, and come December it'll be done? You know, I don't really know. As far as how this service will be rolled out and what will be bundled with it and how it will work, we're hearing a couple of other things. You know, Apple already has Apple Music. They also acquired a company called Texture, which is a magazine subscription service where you pay a flat fee. I believe it's $9.99 a month in the US, so $10 a month, and you get access to 200 different magazines digitally. Now Apple seems to be trying to sign up newspapers to that service, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. They're supposedly in talks with them, although those publications are a little bit reticent to do a deal with Apple because they don't want to lose control over their subscribers. They also charge quite a bit more for their own subscriptions, about $15 to $20 a month, typically, if you want to go direct through them. So it's not clear how Apple would do this service, if they would get the newspapers on board and then roll it in for that flat subscription price of $9.99, or if there'd be more of a premium tier to get the newspaper content, or maybe the newspapers would come in as add-ons, additional add-ons on top of the base Texture price. But supposedly they want to roll in that service. If they're able to pull that off, I think that could be a huge win for consumers. I personally wouldn't subscribe to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal just to get their articles. You know, it comes up occasionally. I need stuff for this show, and I just go off of their free tier when they have it. And if I can't get access to it, I rely on other sources. But if I could get it as part of a magazine subscription service for, you know, with other content for one flat rate, I'd be pretty open to that. And as a matter of fact, I'd be even more open if it was bundled all together with the video service and my Apple Music subscription, something that may happen. Katie Huberty from Morgan Stanley predicts that Apple's video business might be a pretty big hit, with Apple focusing on quality instead of quantity. So it's not going to go head-to-head against Netflix and their seemingly endless supply of original content, but Apple would focus on quality and come in at a lower price point, according to Huberty. Maybe $7.99 a month versus, you know, $15 a month for something like Netflix, or $13. I forget what price they're. I think they're about $13-$12 a month, something like that. And she says they may even combine the music with the video and the magazine service together for, say, a price of about $13 a month. So for the same price you might be paying for Netflix, you could get Apple Music, Apple Video, and their magazine service, news service, all together. And to me, that sounds very, very appealing. And she says if Apple can pull it off, they might reach 50 million paid subscribers on those services by 2025. Now, for comparison, Netflix currently has about 124 million subscribers, but it would still be pretty good growth for Apple. And she thinks that Apple could grow that business from a $500 million business in 2019 to a $4.6 billion business by 2025. Combined with Apple Music, the two services together, she says, could rake in $22 billion by 2025 for Apple. So, you know, Apple's services business has been growing pretty quickly. I think it's only going to grow more exponentially as they continue to add new services like this. And I fully expect them to bundle this stuff together. I even mentioned possibly bundling in iCloud services on top of that and just having one big package, a la Amazon Prime or something like that, but for Apple services. And that sounds very appealing to me. I don't know if it sounds appealing to you. If it does or doesn't, shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, unfortunately, in the news for this week, we got to talk about some exploits in some Mac apps that were discovered this week. Actually, a trio of Mac apps were discovered, of all places, on the Mac App Store. And these apps were grabbing users' entire browsing histories from their Chrome and Safari browsers, zipping it up and uploading it to servers in China. The first piece of software that was detected is an app called Adware Doctor. And ironically, it's an app that purports to protect your browsing from adware and to remove browser extensions, cookies, and caches. Well, yeah, it was doing that, but it was also taking all your browser data and uploading it to the developers of Adware Doctor. And unfortunately, it was an app that was ranked first in the utilities category on the App Store and was the fourth most popular paid app on the Mac App Store. These abuses were uncovered by a security researcher who goes by Privacy One on Twitter, and then he also worked with Patrick Wardell over at Malwarebytes, which is a great company. They make the Malwarebytes software that helps you find and remove malware from your Mac. They've been looking at this stuff for a while. They've even been notifying Apple about it, although Apple has not done much until now. Now, this week they did jump on, and Adware Doctor has been removed. There were a couple other apps, though, that were being distributed by Trend Micro Inc. called Dr. Cleaner and Dr. Antivirus that were found to be doing almost exactly the same thing. Again, the irony here is that Trend Micro is a legit security company. So it's not clear what's going on here, and they haven't responded to questions from the media. They have yet to say what was going on here, other than by issuing a statement where they said, quote, "We take this situation seriously and are diligently digging into this before sharing additional details. We take data privacy very seriously and will do anything necessary to ensure our customers are protected." That's great, but it sounds like a lot of lip service, because this behavior that they were caught doing is very similar to bad behavior that Malwarebytes discovered in the past in another Trend Micro application called Open Any Files. And it was doing very similar stuff, zipping up and sending off your data without asking to Trend Micro's servers. Now, again, what's very concerning about this is these are legitimate apps from developers who have developer accounts on the Mac App Store, so they're not getting caught by Gatekeeper. And as a matter of fact, they're even being, in a way, promoted by Apple, because these are top downloaded apps on the App Store. So you would think that Apple would be fully aware of these applications and investigating them. Luckily, in macOS Mojave, there's some new additional protections for sensitive files like your browser history and email databases. So hopefully this kind of abuse can't go forward in the future. But as John Gruber pointed out, he did a great piece on his Daring Fireball website. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, specifically with the app Adware Doctor. The bigger concern is, how did these apps get so popular and go unnoticed by Apple's app reviewers that they had these exploits in them, that they were doing these things without users' permission that they basically weren't supposed to be doing? The developer of Adware Doctor actually originally called his application Adware Medic, which was exactly the same name as the app that was being developed by Malwarebytes before they changed the name of their app to Malwarebytes. And they had complained to Apple about the abuse. Apple eventually removed the app, but then what this developer did was simply rename his app to the Adware Doctor thing and re-upload it to the App Store, and it continued on just fine without, you know, anybody in the review team really saying anything. Malwarebytes, from that point forward, continued to keep an eye on this developer, and they'd been reporting abuses for years, but they note that Apple has been slow to react, if at all, to remove any of these applications. And so John Gruber asked the question, and rightly so, why weren't these apps under tighter scrutiny? He points out, and we get the point, that, you know, you can't look at every application. Apple has, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of apps that go through their review system. But you would think for the very most popular apps, the top selling apps and stuff like that, that they could take the time to look a little bit more closely, at least the top 10, maybe even the top 100 apps in each category. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, the three apps in question here, they have all been pulled from the Mac App Store, but it's not clear if Apple has activated their kill switch. So if you already have one of these apps and have downloaded it already, you're going to want to remove it from your Mac, get it out of there. So again, the three apps in question are from the Mac App Store. They're called Adware Doctor, Dr. Cleaner, or Dr. Antivirus. Any of those apps, I would advise removing them until they are patched up and fixed, or just avoid them altogether. You know, if companies like Trend Micro have been bad actors in the past, you know, I think past behavior often dictates future behavior. So I would be very leery and weary of these apps, even though, again, at least in the case of Trend Micro, they're a pretty legitimate security company. So it's going to be interesting to see how they respond. I'm a little bit miffed that they're not responding more quickly, because I think this is a pretty serious issue. But, you know, in the case of the developer of Adware Doctor, he had had complaints from Malwarebytes in 2016. He was accused of having fake reviews put up on the App Store. It does seem like he's been gaming the system to get his app into the top 10 list. And this is stuff that Apple generally doesn't allow, but it's been ongoing for a long time, and other people have been complaining, and Apple has not been doing anything about it. So that doesn't bode well for at least the Mac App Store's app review system. And hopefully, now that this has come to light, Apple is going to jump on this and get a little bit more serious. It'll be interesting to see in the coming weeks also how Apple responds to some of the complaints about what has happened here, especially now that, you know, a journalist who they listen to, John Gruber, has kind of pointed this stuff out. So hopefully this stuff changes. Hate to end the news on a bad note this week, but I wanted to make sure you were all aware of these applications in case you have them installed. You're going to want to get your systems cleaned up. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Jamf Now. This episode is being brought to you by Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. You know, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own Mac, your own iPad or iPhone, but what happens when you have other Apple devices? Maybe you're running a small office or a small company. You're a business, you're growing, you have a bunch of digital inventory, you have maybe salespeople that you're issuing Macs and iPhones and iPads and technology to. Once you start doing that, it makes it exponentially harder to manage everyone's Apple devices. And that's specifically true if you're running a virtual company. You have remote employees, and that's more and more common these days. So you likely have a staff of remote people. With Jamf Now, you can actually check your digital inventory, distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy apps, protect your company data, and even lock or wipe your devices as needed from anywhere. Jamf Now manages devices so you can focus on your business instead, and you don't have to have any IT experience. They make it super, super easy. Best of all, MacCast listeners, you can start securing your business today by setting up your first 3 devices for free, and that's forever. And you can add more devices for just $2 per month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/MacCast. That's jamf.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Jamf Now for their support of the MacCast. Something I brought up on the last episode of the MacCast was the fact that I think, you know, iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch upgrade cycles for many of us are starting to slow down. And even those of us who I would call serial upgraders, and I'm including myself in that group, I am the type of person who has always wanted every new version of the iPhone, the iPad, the Apple Watch. Obviously, I don't have infinite funds and infinite money, so that isn't always possible, but I've always felt like I'm in that demand cycle, that I want the next big thing. And over the past few years, that trend and that group of people seems to be, I think, getting smaller and smaller. And so I was saying, you know, for me this year, looking at what we're expecting to hear about this week, I'm excited about all of it. I'm excited for a lot of you who are planning to upgrade and who are ready for upgrades and want to upgrade. But I'm not feeling like I need the next set of things, even iPhones, which is surprising for me, and it surprised me. And so I sort of threw this out to you, and I asked, are you guys excited about this year's upgrades? Are you going to upgrade? Do you want to upgrade? What is it looking like out there? And I got a great, huge response from a lot of you, and a lot of serial upgraders like myself kind of came in with the same opinions. As a matter of fact, James said, quote, I have owned every iPhone every year since the original iPhone, with the exception of the iPhone 3GS. When I look at it, my iPhone 10 has a 6-core chip and it has 256 gigabytes of storage. Like you are saying, Adam, I don't feel compelled to upgrade this year. I love my iPhone 10 and feel good about owning it for another year despite the spec bump coming on September 12th. So he's kind of generally agreeing with me there. And again, here's a person who has always upgraded. Hamish also emailed me and said, quote, I own an iPhone 10 just as you do, and I'm not planning to update for the first time in 4 years due to the lack of innovation. I don't know if there's a general lack of innovation, Hamish, but I get your point. I totally understand. It's like it's an iterative review. It is an S cycle year. And yeah, there's not a lot of huge new advances. You know, it's not like the jump from Touch ID to Face ID is happening this year. So if you already have Face ID, you know, maybe doesn't make as much sense to upgrade. So he's not looking to upgrade his iPhone, but he also mentioned, as far as the watch goes, I have the first gen, the series zero, so I will and must upgrade to get any of the new features, specifically speaking to the fact that the Series Zero is the only version of the Apple Watch that won't support watchOS 5, so you won't get any of the new operating system features if you're a Series Zero. He also says, plus, my battery only goes about 12 hours, and the watch is very slow, especially the workout app. And so it's showing its age, right? A Series Zero, or 4 generations, 4 years into the Apple Watch, it's probably time for those folks to upgrade. And that was kind of the group of people that I really did hear from. Those people with older devices, maybe 2-3 years old, maybe older, iPhone 6s, 7s, 7 Pluses, Apple Watch Series 0. Surprisingly, it seemed like with Apple Watch, people with a Series 1 or later, maybe not as apt to upgrade this time around, but definitely anybody with an Apple Watch Series 0 seems to be primed and ready to upgrade this year. And I think those are going to be huge upgrades for any of you. So if you have an iPhone 7 vintage or earlier, 7 Plus vintage or earlier, or an Apple Watch Series 1, Series 2, I think this year is a very exciting year for announcements. I think what's being talked about at the Gather Round event is going to be very relevant for you, and these are going to be worthwhile upgrades. So again, I'm very excited for those folks. For those of us with maybe newer devices, a year, maybe 2 years old, I think it's more of a wait and see approach. You know, I want to hear what Apple announces. Maybe they're going to blow me away with something and I'm going to switch, and I'll talk to you at the end of the week, you know, Sunday or something like that, and say, you know what, I was totally wrong. I need to have an iPhone XS. Must have it. But barring any huge thing that we haven't heard about, you know, this may be the first year that I skip around. I wait another year on my iPhone. And again, that's surprising to me. I think Apple also may be suffering a little bit too much from making things too backward compatible. I think that's ultimately a good thing, that, you know, the operating system supports older and older devices, and that Apple isn't abandoning older devices. Ian wrote in to say, quote, I'm on an iPhone 6 Plus, and since Apple announced iOS 12 would run on my device and it will bring supposed improvements for older devices, I'm generally thinking I'll hold on to this for another year. It's still working great, even on the original battery. So Ian's not planning on upgrading. He has an older device, but it's because a lot of the features he's looking for are going to come through in the software, and there's supposedly performance improvements for older devices with iOS 12, and a lot of the early reviews and people who have been on the betas have sort of bore that out. So even if you have an older device, you might be a little more hesitant to upgrade this year. And so I think that's ultimately good for users. I don't know if it'll ultimately be good for Apple's bottom line, but I think it's going to be okay, because again, we're hearing from a lot of people, and I'm hearing from a lot of you in the community who are ready to upgrade. I think there's going to be kind of this new cycle that Apple falls into where, and I think they've spread out, you know, users and upgraders in a big enough pattern where you're going to fall into these 2 and 3 year upgrade cycles, or you're going to have big batches upgrading every year. I think it's going to tend to lead to more consistent sales than big giant spikes in sales, although we are expecting about half of iPhone owners to upgrade this year. So the biggest chunk seems to be falling in this year. So mark this year as the sort of super cycle year. I just think that super cycle is going to happen every 3 years, 4 years. We're gonna have to see how that falls, but I think that's the group. And so if you're in that group this year, I'm super excited for you. I'm super excited for Apple's announcements, and I can't wait to talk about what's actually announced in the next episode of the MacCast. But you know, what do you think? Share with me your thoughts, your excitement on what's happening. I know we're just a few days away, so get them in quick, or we'll be talking after the actual announcements. I guess you can also email me after the announcement to say whether you're disappointed or excited. I look forward to getting your emails. The other thing we were talking about on the last episode of the MacCast was I did kind of a redux of my Apple Watch usage, because I had covered this a while back, and then I found I started doing some more health and fitness stuff, and I'm using my Apple Watch a little bit more, and I'm loving my Apple Watch. It's becoming a more integrated device in my life, and I asked you to share, how are you feeling about Apple Watch? You know, are you generally enjoying it? And I received a great bit of feedback from Gene, and he kind of brought up a theory that I had been contemplating about the future of Apple Watch, but didn't really talk about on the show yet. And that is, you know, can the Apple Watch, we're looking to see what's the thing that replaces the iPhone, right? What is the next thing? Because iPhones reached that sort of maturity level where it's just a device. It's a thing kind of everybody has, or smartphones in general, right? Everybody has a smartphone. Who wants a smartphone? It kind of has all the features you want and need. What's the next big sort of leap in technology that we're going to move on to that sort of replaces the smartphone? And I think we're, you know, years away from this. It's not going to happen anytime soon. But I do think, and Gene brought this up, that the Apple Watch, especially now that it has cellular capabilities and or other wearable type devices or products, I think those are the things that may eventually overtake our smartphones. They're going to be the replacements. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One thing Gene brings out in his email that I think is a big factor in it is the kind of blowback on screen time and the iPhones becoming a distraction and taking away from our daily interactions with other people. You know, having this device in front of us, and especially now that people want larger and larger phones, these large devices in front of our face, that takes that stuff away. And a lot of people might argue, well, have a little bit of self-control, you know, put your phone away. And yeah, I get that. And a lot of us can do that, but that's a little bit easier said than done, right? You get that alert, you think, oh, I'm just going to check that message real quick, and then you're sucked into, you know, the Twitter book or Linked Face or whatever the social media platform, Instabook, you know, that you get into, and suddenly you're out of that moment, right? That screen takes you away from whatever you were doing. And with an Apple Watch, it's definitely a little less distracting. I find myself, when I get a notification on the Apple Watch, I'll often look at it, note that it's not really important. I get the information that I need, but then I'm right back in the moment. It doesn't suck me out of that. And that's an interesting phenomenon. And I think there's a lot of devices and products like that. And now that we have a cellular Apple Watch, there are a lot of tasks that you do with your iPhone that it could replace, including things like not just messages and email and calendar and notifications, weather, but also phone calls. If you have a set of AirPods, it's great for phone calls. It's great for music. With watchOS 5, it's going to be great for podcasts, and the ability to stream that stuff and not have to have it all loaded on the Apple Watch. And so I think definitely that the future is going to be in some kind of wearable. Is it going to be a single device like just an Apple Watch? I don't really think so. I think it's possibly going to be a series of smaller connected devices. And by connected, I don't mean physically connected with wires. I mean wirelessly connected, talking to each other. So an Apple Watch, a set of glasses that has an augmented reality display in it. And I don't mean like big, clunky Google weird glasses. I mean regular glasses that look like you're just wearing a standard set of spectacles, or it could even be contacts, or, you know, we'll have inner devices like AirPods, or maybe even something more discreet and integrated. And all of these things will be talking to each other and have good long battery lives and all that sort of stuff. And that aggregate stuff, think about breaking apart your cell phone into its component pieces, a listening and speaking piece, a display, a smaller display type piece, a heads up display in the form of an AR glass, in the form of AR glasses. And I think you're getting to sort of the thing. Maybe even, you know, part of it is a small little iPhone like device that is just a tiny portable screen that you mostly keep in your pocket and you only take out for certain situations. So this sort of breaking up of the cell phone, and you won't get so sucked into it, you know, when you go to look down at your messages. phones really can get in the way. And what we're talking about is a future where the technology enhances your experiences and human abilities. And this is something that Tim Cook has talked about quite frequently. So I do think it's part of Apple's future vision, right? Something that just adds information when you need it. I think AI is going to play a very big role in this. So there's probably going to be some listening elements. It's going to detect and pick up on information. Imagine you're having a conversation with somebody about a topic, and maybe you're not fully informed in that topic, right? You don't know a lot about it. Right now, the trend is, oh, I can grab my iPhone, I can pull up Safari, I can be looking at it, I can be looking up at that information. Think almost, and this is scary to say, but Terminator style, where the information is scrolling up and popping up in front of you, and you can get stats and data. So before you even think, oh yeah, what was that fact about the height of Mount Everest? It's right there in your vision, and you can just quickly glance at it and read that back. Or if your displays are using facial recognition, the one killer app that I want, because I'm terrible at remembering people's names, is facial recognition through my contacts, and it just gives me people's names so it can reaffirm. And often I do remember the name, but I worry that my memory's bad and I'm going to say the wrong name and be embarrassed. So just having that extra affirmation in front of my eyes sounds like a really, really cool thing. And I think also, you know, the AI would suck in information related to the activity, the tasks that you're doing, the people that you're interacting with. I think possibly the data from a technology like Screen Time could come into play. So it would know, when are you using these apps and when are you using those apps and what kinds of information would you potentially need from those applications at any given moment or any given time. And it will be smart about surfacing and bringing up information you need when you need it without you even having to do voice interaction or any other forms of interaction. Of course, voice would be there as a backup interface when you need it. But getting almost more real-time predictive information, I think, is going to be a big part of it. And of course, we'd be able to predefine some of those things based on our hours that we work, our family time, when we're taking vacations, and then the artificial intelligence could tune the apps and data to filter what we get to our devices and our augmented reality displays. And so, you know, I think that's a really cool thing. Another point is that watches, you know, Apple watches are considerably cheaper than iPhones by comparison. Now, when you're adding in, you know, a headset and augmented reality glasses, that may all change in the dynamics of things, but you get the point. And it's almost like you have these component pieces. So if one breaks or you want to just upgrade one piece of it, you can do that. So there's some flexibility that comes into play in there. And this starts to get really interesting to me, and why I wanted to talk about some of it. And I think that's really cool. And I think this could be the future of where this stuff is going. And I think if we look to our current devices like Apple Watch and AirPods and stuff like that, I think we get some hints. And also just pay attention to the statements that Apple's making and the kinds of technology that they're investing in. And it all starts to become a bigger picture. And the dots start to look like they connect a little bit more. And it's really cool. But I'd really love to know what you think about this stuff. Is this the kind of future that you envision? Is this the thing that could replace smartphones that we have today? I kind of feel like it is, but I don't know. I know I'm not the expert. We have a community of very, very smart people, so send me your thoughts. Let me know what you're thinking about. Maccast@gmail.com. Now, one other quick thing, Apple Watch related, that I want to bring up, just because I received quite a few emails about this, actually. In iOS 11, I think in 11.4, Apple finally brought out a feature called Messages in the Cloud. And a few people with Apple Watches have emailed me to say, you know, Messages in the Cloud is not working for me on my Apple Watch. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that Messages in the Cloud only works on iPhone, iPad, and Mac. It's not supported on Apple Watch yet. So that's why it's not working there. But again, several people have asked about this, so I can only assume others in the community have been wondering about this as well, so I wanted to bring it up. In case you don't know what Messages in the Cloud is, it's a feature of iMessage that makes messages work kind of like your IMAP email does on your iOS devices right now, where if you delete a message, a photo, or a conversation on one device, it is removed from all of your devices. And so it would do that inside messages as well. This only works for iMessages, though. It's not for your Greenbubble SMS, MMS messages. Those still will not sync across your devices. And again, it's not part of Apple Watch, and it doesn't look like it's going to be in watchOS 5 either. So I'm not sure why Apple Watch is being left out of the messages in the cloud equation, but if you delete a message on your Apple Watch, it's still going to be there on your iPhone, your Mac, and your iPad. It's not until you delete that using messages in the cloud that it will delete across all of your devices. And in case you don't know how to enable messages in the cloud, it's pretty easy. On iOS, you go into settings, you tap on your name, you tap on iCloud, and then you just make sure that you turn on messages for iCloud. Once you've done that, it will sync everything across. On the Mac, it's very similar. Open up Messages in the menu bar, go to Messages Preferences, click on iMessage, and then select the checkbox next to Enable Messages in iCloud. And when you do that, everything will be synced on your messages, again, between your iPhone, your iPad, and your Mac on iCloud. So that's how you do that. A while back, I talked about something on the MacCast related to Apple Music and how it handles albums, something that I was a little bit frustrated by and something that was brought up in a comment piece by Benjamin Mayo over at 9to5 Mac. And the issue was that Apple Music and iTunes in general basically treats all albums equally, meaning that it doesn't matter if an album is an EP, a single, a compilation, a live album, or the actual studio album, all of them were just simply called album. And with Apple Music coming out and access to more albums and music, and also with Siri technology coming into play, this was kind of a holdover from the iTunes days and the iTunes music store that was causing problems. For a lot of people, you'd ask for a particular album or a particular track, and you would get this weird version, right? You'd get the EP version or the live version or the compilation version, which may or may not be the same as the studio album version, which is probably 90% of the time what somebody was really looking for. And it was a little bit frustrating. And so, you know, you'd ask for the album or track via Siri and it would get all confused and you'd be frustrated and everybody was happy. Well, good news. This week, Apple has apparently fixed that. Now, if you go into iTunes or the Apple Music app and you look at the artist page, you will now see sections for albums, meaning the studio album, music videos, singles and EPs, live albums, compilations, all separate. They also have artist playlists and an appears on section. I don't know if that's new. I never noticed it before, but that's pretty cool. If an artist just happens to appear or be a guest artist on another artist's album, it will show up there as well. So it's all separated, and I have to say thank you, Apple. I don't know if they caught Benjamin Mayo's piece. They certainly didn't hear me talking about it here on the MacCast, but however they heard about it, however they figured out, I'm glad they actually made the change because it is much, much better. And I haven't had too much of a chance to play around with it with my HomePod. I did a little bit of testing when I heard this news, and it does seem to work better. I can call up and ask for a live album and get the live album versus the studio album. And it seemed to work for me. I have to play around a little bit with the phrasing. It wasn't spot on accurate every time. But I thought I'd share that with you, just a little follow-up to a piece we had. This was back in February when I talked about this. So it's been a long time coming. A lot of people have wanted this for a lot, lot longer. So I wanted to share that with you because I thought it was pretty cool news. All right, I want to wrap up the show here talking about the Force. And I don't mean the mystical Jedi Force, I mean Force Touch, because in the past I've discussed on the show my general lack of excitement about Force Touch technology. I think it's cool stuff. I don't use it all that much, and mainly I don't use it all that much because I forget about it. I don't know about it. It's a hidden technology. It's not there in your face. There's no discoverability with it. We recently heard rumors that the LCD iPhone, what's being called the iPhone XC, now might not even support Force Touch. And I've kind of felt like it really isn't going to be missed all that much. And I've commented as much on the show. And there are a lot of Force Touch fans out there. A lot of you really do like it. You know, again, my fundamental issue with it is discoverability. But, you know, even if you do know about it and how it's implemented, another problem I have with the technology is that any app kind of implements it differently. There's no standardization. There's kind of a pseudo standardization that happens in a few areas, but really any app developer can kind of do anything they want with the technology. It's just like an extra click. But once again, it's a hidden click. If you don't know about it, it's essentially not there. Now, a lot of you out there argue, and rightfully so, I totally agree with this. Well, then that just means Force Touch is a power user technology. If you know about it, you can use the power of it and you can get a lot of the advantage from it. You know, it's sort of like knowing keyboard shortcuts. If you're a keyboard shortcut guru, you can do stuff a lot more quickly, efficiently. You're a power user, right? So, I would agree with that. But again, to me, a lot of the Force Touch stuff could be done in other ways, and it just doesn't seem like a necessary technology. So I've never been a huge fan. I'm trying to be more open to it. And Steve wrote in this week to share a Force Touch feature that he really likes and finds useful in an attempt to maybe win me over to the Force, to the good side of the Force, to the Force Touch side of the Force. I don't know how we say that, but I thought it was a great tip. He says he uses it as a quick way to tell which apps in a folder have a specific number of notifications. And what he means by that is if you have an app that provides notifications, say like an email app or a messaging app, right? And it tells you you have 5 new messages in this app. It gives you that little red circle with a number in it in the corner of the app icon. If you put and group your apps, like I group all of my social media apps into a folder, what happens on the folder icon is you get an aggregate of the number. So if, you know, Twitter has 5 and Facebook has 5 and Instagram has 5, that number will say 15 on the folder, but you don't know which ones are, you know, how many are in each application. So with Force Touch, if you Force Touch on a folder that has apps with the little notification number on it, you actually get an individual list showing the individual number for each app. And that's a pretty cool tip. I didn't know about it, again, because not really discoverable. And Steve says, I use that one all the time. It's really handy and I like it. And I think that's really pretty cool. I get that it's handy, but I also get that if I have those apps in a folder and I tap just once, which is the same number of taps, by the way, as Force Touch, I get the same data, right? I can see the individual icons with the individual numbers. Now, of course, this falls apart if those icons are on multiple pages. So yes, the Force Touch one is probably slightly a little bit better because I don't have to do the extra swipe if Instagram happens to be on the second page. But okay, good one. You know, that is a good tip. I think it's a great tip, and it did get me thinking. We have a community of you out there. You have great ideas and great tips, and because Force Touch is kind of this non-discoverable thing, I want you to help me discover Force Touch features that are very useful. I want you to share the tips on how we should all be using the Force. Call it MacCast Jedi training for Force Touch, and we Padawans, those of us who are not wise in the ways of the Force Touch, you can make us Force Touch Jedi Masters with your tips. So what is your tip? What is the best way you use Force Touch? What is the one thing that you do on a daily basis where Force Touch really impacts and makes your use of your iOS device, your iPhone, better and you really like? That is your challenge. That's what I want you to share with me. I will start and I will give you a couple of the areas where I have found Force Touch useful. There's kind of two places where I use it consistently. One is in previewing an attachment in an email. So if there's an attachment icon, I will Force Touch on that to get a little preview to see what that is, especially if it's an image. And related to that, just in general, force pressing on images and messages or notes or whatever I might want to do, an email to then swipe up. So force press and swipe up to get additional options like saving an image or printing it. Usually I'm saving it off to my photo library. So to be able to do that without actually having to tap and then tap the share button, that seems to save a couple of extra presses, in my opinion. So I find that pretty useful. But what do you have? What are your Force Touch tips? Send those to me. emails. Audio comments are greatly welcomed. Just try and keep them short, maybe a minute or two. Send those to maccast@gmail.com, and I look forward to getting those and sharing some of the best tips on future episodes of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to talk about something that is really important and really cool that's going on. It is National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. And of course, cancer totally sucks. That's not really cool. But some of you may know who Stephen Hackett is. He runs the awesome 512pixels.net website and blog, a huge Apple and Mac enthusiast, a huge force in the Apple and Mac community, really great guy. He also runs the awesome Relay FM podcast network. I'm sure many of you listen to some of those great podcasts. If you don't, you should check them out. But every September, he and his family go on a campaign to raise money for St. Jude's Children's Hospital in celebration of National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. Their son, Josiah, unfortunately was diagnosed with a rare type of brain cancer in 2009. He was just six months old. But St. Jude's was there to help them and their family with the best science and medicine available at a time when they really needed it. So it is a cause close and dear to their hearts. It's a great organization. Josiah is doing well. He's now 10. The cancer has not returned. And to kind of celebrate the 10 years, Stephen and his family this year have set a pretty big goal. They want to raise $20,000 this month. So $2,000 for each year of Josiah's life. And I think we can help them do that. So if you are able to donate even a small amount of money or a large one, that would be great. It would be greatly appreciated. If not, it's totally understandable. We all have our situations. You know, if you can't, you can help out in other ways. You can spread the word about the campaign, share the link to it on social media with your friends and family, or even just send Stephen a note of support on Twitter for the campaign. That would be greatly appreciated. You know, basically the point here is cancer sucks. It deserves to be eradicated from this earth, and this is a way you could help out. So the site to donate, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, is heroes.stjude.org/Hackett, H-A-C-K-E-T-T. heroes.stjude.org/Hackett. It looks like they're well on their way to reaching their goal. They're almost halfway there, and I'm hoping the MacCast community can help out here. So if you can, please do. If you can't help monetarily, please share this information out. Give it to your families and friends. Put it on social media, and let's get them to that $20,000 mark. Heck, let's get them to a $40,000 mark if we can, because I think it's a really great cause. And again, Stephen is a great, awesome member of the MacCast community, deserving of our support. So I bring that up. It was something that was pointed out to me by our friends at Smile as well. So check that out, and thanks for doing that. All right, before I leave you, I do want to thank our sponsor, Smile, another great company in the MacCast community. You can get information on all of their great applications and software, Text Expander, PDF Pen for iPhone, iPad, Mac, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. Head to smilesoftware.com/podcast for all of that information. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I want your Force Touch tips, also just your general email audio questions. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com if you want to ask about a tip or a trick. Maybe you need some help with your Mac or iOS devices, or you just have a general comment or question on an episode of the MacCast. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. You'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online on social media, I'm going to be tweeting, I'm sure, about the great things that Apple announces on Wednesday. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. So every social media platform, whatever you choose. I'm also on Instagram. Basically, you can find me everywhere online as MacCast or The MacCast. Just do some Google searching. You'll find it. And I appreciate everyone who gives me a follow. That does really help in promoting the show as well. And if you get a chance, hey, recommend the show to your family and friends who you think might be interested in it. That helps out a lot as well. Also, leave a comment or review on iTunes. I appreciate all the support. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.